From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, new data finds many children of color in Wisconsin go to schools with no teachers who look like them. And when those teachers do get hired, they are more likely to leave classrooms. Then our culinary historian reveals the disconnect between celebrity chef cookbooks and their restaurants.
Every chef I've ever met says, oh no, cooking at home is the most important thing you can do. You should cook, you should share with your friends, your family, it creates traditions. They'll go on, you know, till my ears bleed about how good that is. And then they're like, but come to my restaurant.
Plus, our family recipe series explores the significance of pork ribs and sauerkraut for one Milwaukee woman.
So it's a variety of textures that kind of all work together. And for me, it's the memory of my mom and my culture. And, you know, yeah, this is what I grew up with. This is kind of my home dish.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. It's Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. A new report from a University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee researcher highlights one reason African-American teachers may leave classrooms: trust issues in the work environment. Surveys taken in 2017 show that Black teachers have lower perceptions of trust with other teachers. It also found that white teachers are less trusting of Black principals. UWM researcher Curtis Jones says the trust breakdown is important for Wisconsin schools to address because the state needs more educators of color. WUWM education reporter Emily File spoke with Jones and to Katie Rainey. She works in educator support at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. DPI has partnered with Jones, using his research to inform its teacher effectiveness efforts. Jones started by talking about the racial mismatch between students and teachers in K through 12 schools.
It's really important for a student of color to have at least one experience having a teacher from their same ethnic background, much more likely to graduate high school on time and even go to college.
If a student of color has a teacher who looks like them.
Yes, who's from their background. And so the question was, well, how many students of color are getting that experience in Wisconsin? We know that there's about 33% students of color in Wisconsin. What's been going on with the teaching population, unfortunately, is it hasn't kept up with that. We have, outside of the Milwaukee Public Schools, I think it's fewer than 2% of teachers are either African-American or Latinx, while I think it's like 15% of students are. And what we ended up finding out was that if you just looked at all of the schools across the state, 86% of schools had no African-American teachers, and 83% had no Latinx teachers, but only 10 schools across the whole state had no African-American or Latinx students.
So the students in Wisconsin are getting more diverse, and the teachers are not. And the vast majority of Wisconsin schools do not have any African-American or Latinx teachers.
That's right.
And then, Katie, do you want to speak to... So there's clearly this issue in the mismatch between students and teachers in Wisconsin schools in terms of the racial demographics. But then there are also some disheartening numbers when it comes to retention of Black teachers especially.
I think Curtis's study helps to identify that we can't just focus on diversifying the pipeline, that we also have to focus specifically on retention. So just getting more educators of color licensed and in buildings is not enough, because currently what we're finding is that educators of color are more likely to leave not just the building but the profession at a much higher rate, and that shift, that gap, happens within the first 2 years of their employment. So there's something happening within that first 2 years that is significantly impacting those educators in a way that is different than their white colleagues. And that's regardless of the type of school or district or the population and demographics of that school or district, that across the state, educators of color are leaving the school and the profession at, is it more than double?
It's a lot more than double.
Okay. It's significantly faster within those first 2 years.
Do you want to get into some of those numbers?
Well, I'll try to remember them directly. And you know, it's important to also consider that the that this particular study was one time period. We've looked at other time periods, and the numbers are a little different. There's still a big disparity.
And what time period was this study?
This was, I think, starting in 13-14, following teachers through 18-19. And we found that within the first 2 years, the teachers of color had much lower retention rates, both in their school and within the profession. And it's really low for African-American teachers, where I think the retention of teachers in the profession was just barely above 50%.
Okay, so retention is an issue, representation is an issue, and then you explored in this study, you know, one answer to the potential question of why. Why do teachers, why do Black and Latinx teachers leave the classroom at higher rates? And you looked at one possible cause, the trust between teachers and their peers and teachers and principals. So talk about how trust correlated with retention.
Sure, right. We thought, well, let's look at the trust between teachers and teachers and principals as a potential explanation for why a teacher might leave. We knew historically that the trust between a teacher and a principal was a probably the biggest predictor of whether or not a teacher would stay in that school. And so we know that
the biggest predictor?
Yeah, of whether or not a teacher would stay in that school, at least of the information that we have. Teachers leave the principal more than they leave the school. And so since there was a lot of teachers of color leaving schools, well, maybe there was something there that was consistent with that. So we found that African-American teachers across the board reported lower levels of trust between teachers in their school. And this is regardless of context. And that white teachers reported lower levels of trust with principals of color and with more diverse teaching groups within a school. So the more diverse the teachers were in a school, the less trust white teachers reported having with those teachers. And so when we accounted for those things, it partially explained some of those retention differences we saw between groups. The trust that we saw between teachers was a pretty strong predictor of whether or not a teacher would stay in that school. And the trust between teachers and principals was also a pretty strong predictor of whether or not they would stay in that school. So it just made sense. And there's a lot of research out there nationally that speaks to this. And so we felt pretty confident that that was at least part of the story.
And it brings up a lot of questions that you can't answer from this existing data.
Right.
About why there are these hang-ups in trust between teachers and principals of different races. Katie, what was your reaction to this research?
I think it speaks to bias. And so, you know, that was one of the things that we know is an issue. And to be able to have data to tell a story, even if it's not the full story, is really powerful in terms of informing potential changes or next steps.
What should schools do with this information? And what does DPI plan to do at this point?
The discussions are very new. So we presented this to Cabinet just about a month ago.
What do you mean by that when you say Cabinet?
Sorry, Cabinet is our upper level leadership. So it includes the state superintendent, Carolyn Stanford Taylor, as well as our deputy superintendent, Mike Thompson, and then each of the assistant state superintendents who are the heads of the five departments within the agency. Dr. Stanford Taylor has been very specific and outspoken about her vision for the agency and having it be a focus on equity. And so their conversations at the cabinet level have been, what does that specifically mean? And what are we going to focus on? And what are the levers and the policy, you know, tools that we can use to try to make a difference for equity within education? And so the timing of this report was just you know, very timely in that we were able to present to them before they started having some of those conversations. And we basically asked that they consider this data as they go deep into those discussions. Diversifying the workforce is one of the key aspects that they've been talking about. And so we asked them to consider as they're having the conversation specifically around diversifying the workforce to focus also on retention.
Mm-hmm. Especially in those first 2 years. It seems like if you can build a strong relationship of mutual trust between a principal and a new teacher in their first 2 years, they're much more likely to stay in that school and to stay in public education.
Exactly.
And Curtis, what do you think are some of the strategies that could be used to help tackle some of the issues raised in this report?
The number one strategy that we've been thinking about related to this has been related to how there's a lot of equity training and bias training that teachers are going through and have been going through within schools. And it's been focused on teachers' relationships with students of color and with parents of color. And so a lot of teachers understand implicit bias and things like this that are in relation to how they're interacting with students and parents. I don't know of any initiatives in Wisconsin that are focused on how teachers work together to promote trust amongst each other. You know, increasing the pipeline is an important part of this, but what we need to do is make the teaching profession more attractive to persons of color. As it is right now, how are we going to sell this to a person of color as a career opportunity if we know that they're going to be placed into a school where they're likely having lower trust with other teachers and, you know, less satisfaction with their job?
Mm-hmm. Right. You don't want to be saying to future teachers of color, enter this field. You have a 1 in 2 chance of staying in your job in 2 years.
Right.
Because basically half of new African American teachers leave their school within 2 years.
That's right. We need to figure out how to keep the teachers we have before recommending a bunch of new teachers to go into that system.
Because ultimately it's better for kids.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's in a big part of this research was about, you know, the fact that the racial achievement gap in Wisconsin is the largest of any state in the United States. And why is that? Well, some kind of foundational factors for that are students of color do not, for the most part, get the experience of working with a teacher from their same ethnic background. And the teachers in the schools with the, you know, majority students of color are still majority white and are much less likely to stay in those schools. So teacher retention on both ends of this harms the students of color and then exacerbates that achievement gap. We need to figure out how to fix the, you know, human resource system within Wisconsin schools so that it promotes gap closing, not gap expansion.
Curtis Jones is a senior scientist and education researcher at UWM. Katie Rainey is director of educator development at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. They join WUWM's education reporter, Emily Files. Emily is interested in hearing from Black and Latinx teachers to talk about their experiences working in Wisconsin schools and whether this research into retention and trust resonates with what they've seen. You can reach her at files@uwm.edu. The History of American Cookbooks and the Rise of Aspirational Cooking. Food historian Kyle Sherrick joins us next when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Food is essential to life, but cooking food well is not a skill any of us are born with. Not all of us have the time, money, or inclination to take cooking classes either, or had parents who taught us to cook when we were growing up. So enter cookbooks. Many of us have a copy of The Joy of Cooking or another all-purpose cookbook in our kitchens. And many more of us have specialized cookbooks as well that focus on a cuisine or a cooking technique. Cookbook sales are outpacing many other kinds of books, but how many of us actually use those cookbooks to actually make a dish or a meal? Kyle Cherik has done some research. He's a culinary historian and essayist and also a Lake Effect contributor, and he joins me in the studio now. Kyle Cherik, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Bonnie. How are you?
I'm doing really well, and we're going to be talking about one of my favorite things, which is cookbooks.
Which is a great thing to do in the early 2020 years as people make resolutions to do things, and many of them are to cook more, whether that happens or not, but it's a dignified and it's a good resolution.
One of the things I love about cookbooks, though, is when you look at them, particularly the historical ones, it kind of gives you an insight into the culture that was happening there. We might think we know where that dish came from, or we might think we know what it meant, but it might often not mean what we think.
Exactly right.
And I love digging back into the old ones. My mother collected old American cookbooks.
Right.
And so there were always, and she would use them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was mostly to have them there as just like, isn't this interesting? They made this in New Hampshire in, 1706.
Right, right. Well, yeah, they're probably, just because I know my history too well, they probably weren't doing cookbooks quite then, because our first American cookbook is 1796, but with Amelia Simmons. And we'll get there, but it's so true that these are cultural markers of the time. And in the case of Amelia Simmons, it tells us so much about what Americans, at least on the East Coast, right? That sort of bubble.
The colonies.
But that's where most of America was. And she was working as, she was an orphan, and she was working as a domestic, and she was working as a cook and things like that. And in those days, to be self-published was not a dint on your shoulder. Many people were, heck, Walt Whitman published himself because, he was a printer. So self-published wasn't a big deal. The really interesting thing with her American Cookery cookbook was that the person that edited it, we don't know who edited it because she gave it off to a printer and said, this is my cookbook. And it sold very well. And out of it, we've got a lot of codified recipes that now we just take for granted.
Like what?
Well, the American drop cookie, I mean, basically the chocolate chip cookie, comes out of that. And if you talk about, does America have a pastry tradition or a baking tradition? You know, all of that came from Europe. But the drop cookie is an American invention, and she codifies it for us in that book. What's really interesting, though, is that the person that she didn't know was editing it essentially changed some of her dispositions. She had some very, very, very strong feelings about meat. She had some very strong feelings about eating in the season or when to eat these things and so forth. And they just said, nope, that's not what I agree with. I'm gonna rework it. I'm going to put these things into different chapters and so forth. And now we look at it and say, wow, this is a really amazing, thoughtful work. The truth is, it is, but it's the work of two people, Amelia Simmons, and then
this unknown
ghostwriter.
Yeah.
Yeah. That just grabbed the reins and said, this is what it's going to turn out to be.
So she was actually a proponent of eating within the seasons?
Oh, well, everybody was because,
well,
they had to. But the emphasis on it was very strong within that. And she was a proponent of sort of sorting through the seasons by way of the things that you could put up. So the things that they could be preserved. And it seems just common day to us now with the farm-to-table movement and so forth, which really started in the 70s. But, you know, to basically have that laid out that here, if you don't know these things, if you didn't automatically learn them from grandma, grandpa, aunt, uncle, what have you, here's the guide to when these things are best fresh. Here's when they should be pickled or preserved. And here's how you can use them, more importantly, later in dishes for deliciousness.
Because if you're going to pickle it and then not eat it,
what's
the sense?
Well, if you're going to eat it, but you're going to eat it because it's just the calories that you have at the time, here's how you can use it by way of deliciousness. And it was this great practical guide to just, this is how we eat in America. And American food is very funny because if we think about what American food is, if you stop somebody in the street, they would probably say pizza, hamburgers, hot dogs. You know, those are all things that we eat when we go out. I don't know the last person, aside from maybe the 4th of July, that actually made a hot dog at home.
or made a pizza, not a frozen one.
Not a frozen one, yeah. And some people have pizza stone, but it's really, that's kind of a special thing, and it's fun to do, and, you know, whatever. Friends come over and you drink wine and you make pizzas. It's not like this is Wednesday night and we need to put dinner together. So American cuisine or things out of cookbooks is really an interesting anomaly. And we've had this robust dining scene for a long, long, long time. But when a Russian count toured America in the early 1800s, he said point blank, you don't have a cuisine, because everywhere he'd eaten, it was French. And that's where we've been living with cookbooks, this French hegemony, basically, until the 1980s. And we'll talk a little bit later about Lydia Bastianich, who you interviewed and then I interviewed in front of a live audience. You know, she was part of that Leonard Cohen, the crack, so the light gets in, you know, of Italian cooking that broke that French hegemony that had come basically from the 1930s and the World's Fair. So the way that French food became what it did here in America was during the World's Fair in Queens, over came Soleil and Farnay. And Farnay was just a low kitchen boy, but he worked his way up to head chef. And they ended up, Farnay in particular, ended up being best friends with Craig Claiborne, who was the incredibly influential, the nation's first restaurant critic. And if you look at the list of the best cookbooks in America, 100 most important, the New York Times cookbook, that one that he published in the 60s and then every year on forward through the 70s, they were all Farnay's recipes. They'd go out to Claiborne's place in the Hamptons. Farnay would cook, and Claiborne would type. And that's, you know, and then Julia before that, and that sort of thing. But French food was what we were cooking out of cookbooks now. And we've really moved on since then.
Well, what about cookbooks like Fanny Farmer's?
Sure.
And all of those earlier ones that kind of were passed down, you know, housewife to housewife kind of thing, mother to daughter.
Yeah.
Where it was the basic, I'm putting air quotes around, the basic American how to roast.
Right, right.
Something, how to bake bread, how to just cook everyday basic things.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
so where did those start happening?
Well, so Fanny Farmer is mid-19th century, and it's really a teaching school that she has in Boston, and that's where that cookbook comes from, making a huge story very small. But she was teaching women these incredible skills.
Home ec, essentially.
Yeah, before we had, just as we get physical education from the Turners and that tradition, we got home ec out of Fanny Farmer. And it was really the demand and the interest to create that cookbook. And there's always been two levels of cookbooks going on in America. There was the Amelia Simmons American Cookery and Fanny Farmer and The Joy of Cooking and those sorts of things.
I have my dog-eared copy of that.
Yeah. And I would include the Immigrant Cookbook, which came out of Milwaukee, Lizzie Kander Black, incredibly influential. But that was this very straightforward, pragmatic, this is how you cook. Definitely it's delicious. Here's how you use the things. Here's how you can stretch them into other recipes. And then there was the fancy pants cookbooks.
The aspirational cookbooks.
Yes. Yeah. And we're still living in that age. And it's interesting, like the two women we'll talk about, Samin Nosrat, who I interviewed around the same time that I interviewed.
And she is salt.
Salt, fat, acid, heat. Yeah. Wild, wild cookbook success. I mean, she is in line with what Julia Child did for sales with Mastering the Art of French Cooking. She's on that. We sort of, you know, Julia Child and then the Silver Palette cookbook and then I don't even know what would be in between as far as success. And then you've got Samin's Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. And at the same time, she got this incredible Netflix special that followed up. And, you know, her series was literally helping add subscriptions to Netflix. I mean, she went from writing for the Berkeley newspaper and helping Michael Pollan learn about food as he wrote his book to being an international star. In the food world, there are people in all of the celebrities in cooking that I've met in the past decade plus of going to the James Beard Awards or Kohler Food and Wine or various things like that, or the chefs that have come through. So Thomas Keller all the way through. So I mean, there are people that are exactly as you want them to be and how they are when they write or when they're on camera. And Lydia Bastianich was the same way. And then there are those that, and I'm not judging, but have a bifurcation of personality. Samin is exactly what you get when you meet her, which was incredibly delightful. And her book, to me, is interesting because it's a crossroads where it's aspirational cooking, but it's actually very basic reteaching of techniques. So it sort of sits in both camps. You know, we're living right now in the era of Yotam Ottolenghi, right? So there's this trend towards like Mediterranean, North African sort of Spanishy, Basque-y, Greek-y,
all those flavors and those textures.
Yeah. And Otto Lengi's first book is, Plenty to me is like Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses, where everybody bought it, is on the New York Times bestseller list forever, but no one read it.
And nobody's ever cooked anything. Nobody's
ever cooked it. But if you go to people's kitchens, you're like, oh, there's another copy of Plenty, but when did you make that eggplant that's on the cover? Never.
Okay, so that leads me to a question. I was like, what is driving this aspirational need?
Yeah, yeah.
For people to have these cookbooks to say, oh, that just looks so great and everything, but then actually never go into the kitchen and try making whatever it is that drew them to the cookbook in the first place.
I think it's a touch point towards the food, and I think that our social media and culture influences this. So since 2015, the two graph lines as far as grocery sales, which is up in the billions every year, and then restaurant sales, usually it was grocery was higher and then restaurant was, flatlining or moving up, but grocery always beat out. They've, like in Ghostbusters, those of you from the 80s that remember that, those streams have crossed. So grocery sales have dipped down and restaurant sales have dipped up. And I'm talking by a billions of dollar spread. So people are not cooking. You can't cook without groceries unless everyone's suddenly farming in their backyard. But, I don't think it's that big.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, right. That's a totally different discussion of ours.
Yeah.
So people aren't cooking at home as often, and they're definitely eating out. And eating out has become the national recreation. Buying these cookbooks, there's a couple of things happening. One, it's the touch point to the food that looks delicious, but in many cases people won't make it home, but it connects you to the chef. So in a way, eating out, right? And it's also the grand baseball card in the case of celebrity chefs like Yotam Ottolenghi or Samin Nosrat. You watch her on Netflix and then you want the cookbook so you can flip through it, but you don't actually cook out of it in many cases. So it's that Instagram you can hold in your hand that is this through point. Because cookbook sales since 2015 have been gaining momentum to the point of 20% increases or more. 2018 was 21%. The year before that was a little more than. But each year. So whereas publishing is supposedly dead in this digital era, and oddly enough, I can get pretty much any recipe that I want on my phone in my kitchen when we do cook, or some verisimilitude of it. If it isn't Yotam's, I can get a version of that, right, to go off of that theme. Yet cookbook sales are going
through the roof,
whereas publishing is sort of struggling and, only the Don DeLillos of the world are making money.
So when you talk to all of the chefs that you talk to, mm-hmm. and most of them have cookbooks,
yep.
are they disappointed that people aren't actually cooking their food?
Every chef always wants people to cook their food. It's the strangest existential crisis I've ever encountered, and I keep waiting.
I'm buying the books, but I'm not going
to
cook.
Yeah, well, I keep waiting to find, that the person that just takes a stand on one side or the other. But every chef, in the case of Samin, she doesn't have restaurants to support, so she wants people to cook at home. But in the case of Lydia, she has many, many a restaurant empire and Italy to support, so she wants people, one, buying groceries to cook and then going into her restaurant, right? Every chef I've ever met says, oh, no, cooking at home is the most important thing you can do. You should cook. You should share with your friends, your family. It creates traditions. They'll go on, till my ears bleed about how good that is. And then they're like, but come to my restaurant.
Come but to when my you don't want to cook.
let me cook for you.
Yes.
And Daniel Ballou, we had this conversation where he gave me the book. He was here a number of years ago at the Grain Exchange, lovely Bartolotta event, gave me the book, his card, his cell phone number, come to New York, we'll cook for you. I don't know if you'll use any of these recipes because it takes, that sort of thing. But do you cook at home? I said, well, yes, of course, chef. Yes, I do. But it was like, but still, come to the restaurant. Come to the restaurant. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like they've had to split their, mm-hmm. Their desires in a way. It's like I'm cooking for you, but I also want you to try the things that I've created in this book.
Well, their restaurant is definitely their wife, but, cook at home is their mistress. Otherwise, it just doesn't work with cookbooks.
Don't bring the cookbook to the restaurant.
Yeah.
Because that could be really ugly.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, but, and there are people that eat out every night. And I think that would just get tiresome. I mean, I know those times in my life when traveling and so forth. And, by the seventh, eighth night, you're just looking at another menu.
Right.
You just, I mean, it really gets to be exhausting.
Yeah, there is something about a home-cooked meal, mm-hmm. As simple can be,
yeah.
that sometimes is exactly what you need. And if only because you don't have to be on while you eat it.
Yeah.
Like in a restaurant, you're still around other people. There's a certain kind of, you want to be polite to the wait staff. You want to, be polite to your companions, whatever it happens to be. But you can just sort of relax
at home. Something else is interesting has happened in that. So if you go out, when we go out dining, one of the things that really troubles me but I can't do anything about is the F and the P. So it's the food and the phone. And I see people not conversing. If they're sitting alone, they're basically looking at a little 3 or 4 inch glowing thing in front of them, and they're missing the magic of the food. And I'm talking even if you're at a Big Bowl or something.
I was going to say your local fish fry.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. I mean, there's still there was human intention and thoughtfulness, varying levels, but still, you can't. It's not Star Trek. You can't just create this, hit a button, and boom. There's fewer and fewer things where actually human energy. And as you go up the scale, artistry comes into play. And
that directly.
Correct.
It's like where you're the recipient. It's literally a one-on-one exchange.
Yeah. And there's nothing more intimate than food. You put it in your body. What else do we put in our body? We put air, we put water, and we put healing medicines. I mean, when you really break it down, and food is a form of medicine, of course, but... I mean, it's so intimate, and we miss that when we move into this other space through our phones. The other interesting thing that's happening in our culture, a lot of the consulting that I'm doing right now is in the urban food space within how folks are developing Milwaukee, Madison, other cities, that sort of thing, and placing the right chefs with the right projects. And I was sitting in a meeting, and the president of one of the biggest developers here in the city said, one of the things that we're challenged with right now is our mail and package spaces, not because of Amazon, but because of the overwhelmingness of Blue Apron, et cetera, that is filling up these spaces. So there are folks that are living in these gorgeous, by my standards, lovely apartments or condos in a full urban experience where there are restaurants that they can, in many cases, walk to. And they want to cook at home, but they don't know how to, or they're too busy, or whatever their reasons are. So they get this, the cilantro is already chopped, the box that comes, and you're really just combining. Julia Child is rolling over her. She's probably swearing, in fact. She's probably. Yeah.
In French.
Slamming the wine glass down and swearing. And if this is an access to people eating a little bit more inventively and nutritiously, I guess that's good. It's a really, really interesting time in American culture because we have cookbook sales up. We have, in our city alone, we have 50 or 60 restaurants opening every year. And then we have food being delivered that's basically all but prepared, nearly instant, filling in people's, mailboxes.
Well, and the other thing I've noticed is that the Food Channel, you can now subscribe and get quote-unquote live cooking classes with people like Bobby Flay or whoever happens to be on the roster of Cooking Channel, you know. And so it's like the Peloton of cooking.
It's like,
and I'm thinking, nobody I know is cooking.
Yeah.
And again, that's like aspirational, something.
Well, and are people watching it because of the entertainment value of Bobby Flay, who's a fantastic entertainer?
Right.
Or are they actually cooking along with him? When Julia did it in the 60s, people were cooking along with her. When President Eisenhower's another national address, basically preempted her show, WGBH, got thousands of phone calls, and then in the ensuing week, another thousands of letters, angry, saying, "What are you doing?" That's when we learn how to make, that's our Julia. Well, the president had something to say. Whatever. We get the paper at 5:00. It'll keep. I'm learning how to make bouillabaisse.
I was going to say, I'm deboning a chicken.
And I don't think we don't have that connection. And the Food Network is also, that's them sort of scraping, saying, how do we win at this streaming game and this direct contact where it's the McDonald's, where really the Burger King ethos, where you can have it your way in whatever media you're consuming whenever and wherever. I mean, everything short of from your Apple Watch to your massive movie screen television.
Well, I have to say there is something I still love about picking up a cookbook. I still have a number of my mother's old ones. Mm-hmm. You know, the covers are kind of coming off, and I haven't made anything out of them in years, but I still want them. And there's a connection not only to her, but to that earlier time and who we were then.
No question. And they really are time capsules of what's important to the culture at the time. I mean, the growth of vegan and vegetarian cookbooks that are coming out in 2020, or that won James Beard's in the last couple of years as best cookbook, or that they even have that category, best vegetable-centric cookbook, tells you something about the culture. Mm-hmm. Where 6-8 years earlier, meat was everything. Right? And people were in love with bacon, and now we're swinging in a different direction. As a food historian and a culinarian, this is just fascinating to keep an eye on.
You are going to have lots to do.
You're
never going to run out of things to talk about.
No, good to go. Yeah.
Well, Kyle Cherek, it has been such a pleasure.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Talking about this, and now I have to go look at my cookbooks.
Yeah. Exactly.
Maybe I will actually make something.
Well, and in a little bit of prep for our discussion, I may have put about 45 cookbooks in my cart on Amazon. I'm just saying.
You might want to take a few out.
They're all just reference points. I'm probably not going to get them all, but someday.
Someday. Kyle Cherek, thanks.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherek is a culinary historian and essayist. You can find more of our conversations about food history at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then no cookbooks are needed for our latest family recipe episode, although we will provide the recipe on our website. This month, we'll share a hearty German dish that is sure to warm you up this winter. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. It's winter, and many of us love a good, hearty dish for supper. In this episode of Family Recipes, Linda Gruss shares her mother's recipe for German pork ribs and sauerkraut with contributor Lucian Jung. Served over boiled or mashed potatoes, the tender ribs and vegetables are seasoned with bay leaves, juniper berries, and caraway seeds. It's a classic home-cooked meal that many Milwaukeeans may fondly recall from childhood.
Back in the day, and I'm talking the 60s and early 70s, the taverns in Milwaukee were more like community centers. And on Sundays, maybe once a month after church, you would gather at the local tavern. They would cover up the pool table with plastic. And one of the women, or even the men, if they were good cooks, they would pass around this Nesco cooker and take turns making the main dish of a potluck lunch after church in the tavern. And I know my mom's was always ribs and sauerkraut.
So you remember that from these big potluck meals?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even the taverns in the backyard, they would have a little swing set for the kids. So the kids would go to the tavern, they would go in the backyard and play. When it was time to eat, you know, their parents would make up a dish for them. You would have your big potluck lunch, and about 2 o'clock, you would head home and watch a Packers game.
This does sound so Milwaukee.
So Milwaukee. It's very Milwaukee, and it's definitely what I remember. So the easiest thing to do would have been to just buy some bone-in country ribs. By the way, you should have bone in the meat.
Why the bone? It sounds like it makes it a little more complicated.
It gives it a much richer and more robust taste. The bone actually has flavor. And the other thing you'll notice is that there is some fat on here as well, because fat is what's used to transfer the flavor. That's where the juniper berries and the bay leaves and the caraway seeds are going to the flavor molecules are going to kind of cling to that fat.
So now, are pork ribs tender right away, or is this something that has to braise for a long time?
Yeah, it has to braise for a long time, and these will really break down and actually fall off the bone. And that's kind of the sauerkraut dish, is you're going to have a mix of meat and the sauerkraut and some of the vegetables that have been used to put together the stew, this braised stew.
So your mother was born and raised in Germany.
Yeah, in Mecklenburg-Pomeran. She was born in Parchim and escaped from Koszalin, which is now Koszalin in Poland, in 1949. And then she worked for the American Hospital in Heidelberg, got her bachelor's in chemistry and was a medical technologist, worked for the Army Hospital. And that's how she met my dad. He was in the Army and had malaria from Korea, and they shipped him to Heidelberg to recuperate.
Wow.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a lot, right? Good history. But it's one of those things, though, food, because my mom did almost starve to death during World War II, food was always really important to her, and she was kind of a food hoarder. But she was also one of the most talented, amazing cooks. She could just take whatever was in season, mix it together, and just make a delicious, full, nutritious meal on the spot.
Do you remember the last time she made this for you?
The last time she made this was probably a year before she passed. She passed away when she was 90, a little shy of 91.
Wow.
Yeah. And even almost to the end, she was still cooking. She had to stop cooking when she went on oxygen all the time because she only did gas cooking, by the way, also. So, yeah. But she always was a wonderful cook. And that's kind of how she made friends and introduced people. And she was always interested in new recipes, too. So being a military wife and being married to someone in the military, she would meet wives from Korea, from Japan, from the South, from other regions of the U.S. that she had never lived before. My dad's favorite was spaghetti and meatballs. And I fluctuated between the Hungarian goulash and sauerkraut.
So even as a kid, you liked sauerkraut?
I did. Maybe because it wasn't that sour straight out of the can. Like I said, it's a savory dish. It's got meat, it's got vegetables. And when you mix it with mashed potatoes, how can you go wrong?
I think it's just nowadays you think about kids wanting McDonald's and all that stuff.
Well, you know, being a traditional German as well, the girls in the family needed to know how to cook and how to crochet, how to sew on a button and do some just minimal repairs. So, because you had to take care of your man. I mean, you know, that was the old school stuff, right?
So as a kid, your mom was teaching you how to cook.
Oh, yes. I started cooking when I was 8.
Do you remember the first time you made this for your mom?
Yes, I do. And she really enjoyed it. She
Were you nervous actually serving it to her?
Oh, absolutely, because my mom was really honest. So if there was something wrong with the dish, she would tell me. And so the first time I made the sauerkraut was really good. I think I made it another time after that and kind of rushed it a little bit, and she could tell and let me know what I did wrong. So she always kept me honest and kept me to a very high standard when it came to cooking, because she had a reputation to uphold. and I was an only child, so.
So no child of hers was going to serve inedible sauerkraut.
Absolutely, actually any dish that I made. And but it rubbed off. I did the same kind of tricks with my daughter, maybe not as harsh as my mom, but she is a wonderful cook as well in her own right. So we've kind of passed along that cooking tradition and that love of cooking and food.
Well, there is something about that older generation. They had, there's just, it's different. How would you say that even your daughter's different from your mother?
Actually, my daughter is more like my mom than I'm like my mom.
Really?
My daughter is definitely more assertive, but I think it comes from self-confidence, which my mom had as well. I mean, but my mom had it for a different reason. She was a survivor. She lost her entire family during World War II. She was a true orphan. Her brothers, her mother, her father, her grandparents were all killed during the war. She had nobody. At 24 years old, when the American GIs found her, she was 86 pounds. So her strength and her assertiveness and, you know, not taking guff from anyone and doing the right thing came from her experiences. Where I think now, for my daughter and her strength, it just comes from a cultural shift that says it's okay for girls to be strong, it's okay for women to be strong and smart and have opinions and share those opinions.
When it comes to the things that your mother went through in her life, when you heard some of the stories that she would tell you, was it real for you, or did it take time for it to kind of sink in?
Well, of course, when I was younger, didn't quite understand. But the older you get and the more experiences that you have and the more people that you meet, actually, I think the experiences that she had then are more relevant now than they ever were before.
How so?
Talking about just migrants and immigrants and coming from war-torn countries and trying to find a safe place and a welcoming place. You have to remember, my mom came to the U.S. in 1957. And the war was still very fresh in people's minds. And here's a German, you know, coming. So she actually had to go through some of those prejudices. And, you know, they didn't understand that. I went through the same thing that your people went through in this war. All of us suffered. So I think definitely she had more compassion, too. And I think she did that through her food. She would cook big meals. She didn't know how to cook a small meal for one or two. She would cook a big meal, and she would invite over neighbors. Come on over. I made goulash. Here she would pack up a dish and send them home with it. So you don't have to cook dinner tomorrow. So that was her way of showing kindness and compassion to people, was she cooked for them. Okay, so we have browned the salt and peppered and browned the ribs, and now I'm going to put them in the stew pot.
Okay, so I see you have some bay leaves set out here.
I have bay leaves, I have some caraway seeds, some juniper berries, but first I'm going to start with the vegetables.
Do you mind if, can I just smell the juniper berries?
Okay.
Mm-hmm,
it smells like gin.
It smells like a absolutely delicious gin and tonic. But with a slight peppery note to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Okay, so now we're going to be...
So now we're going to do a medium onion. And I'm going to just put those on top of the browned ribs that are in the stew pot. And next is going to be some garlic. Once you get the browning of the ribs done, this is actually a pretty simple recipe. It's just some chopping and vegetables and...
Now this is a tomato.
Yes, this is a half of a large tomato, and I'm just going to rough chop this. And then the final vegetable is not a vegetable, it's a fruit. It's a Granny Smith apple.
Although this is interesting.
And this adds sweetness and a different kind of tartness to the sauerkraut, and of course it goes well with pork.
And it's
now the sauerkraut.
Okay, now it's time for the sauerkraut.
Right. The European sauerkraut in a jar, which is kind of what I like.
Well, how is European sauerkraut different from just regular sauerkraut?
It's not quite as sour. It's more of a salty brine, and they actually do let it ferment for a while and then toss that brine and then pickle it in the jars. So it doesn't have that really harsh, overpowering vinegar taste. And so just like you would open a can of beans and kind of rinse the liquid that they're stored in, that's what I'm doing here with the sauerkraut. And that looks pretty good. So now we're going to take the sauerkraut and we're just going to dump it in the pot on top of everything else.
Yeah, I mean, so you've layered in, you've got the first layer are the browned pork ribs, and then you added the onion sliced, and then the garlic, and the tomato, and the apple, and now a jar of sauerkraut.
A big jar. It's a 3-pound-plus jar of sauerkraut, and I'm going to evenly distribute this through. And now I'm going to put in those spices and some broth. I had some homemade beef broth that I had frozen. I didn't have enough for the whole pot, so I'm supplementing it with some granulated beef broth that I had on hand. It's a German brand.
Okay, so to the pot, you're going to add about six cups of beef broth.
Yeah, and then I'm going to add the spices and kind of tuck those in there. So I have, it all depends on the size of your bay leaves. I usually do 3 large ones, but I only have medium size, so I'm doing about 5 bay leaves. And now I'm going to add about 2 tablespoons of juniper berries. These will be free-floating in the sauerkraut, but do not eat them.
Yeah, don't eat the juniper berries.
No, don't eat the juniper berries. We just kind of pick them off to the side.
And now
last but not least is caraway seed. And now we're just going to cover it and let it simmer for about 2 hours.
Wonderful. Okay, so the pork ribs have been stewing for several hours now. And how do we serve this? Do we just serve this in a bowl?
You serve it with potatoes, either boiled potatoes that you can just fork mash yourself, or I just happen to have some mashed potatoes that I made, so we're going to have our sauerkraut with our mashed potatoes. As you can see, the meat kind of falls apart.
Yeah, it's so tender.
Yeah, and again, don't eat the juniper berries. Or the bay leaves. Don't eat the bay leaves either. Just remember to do meat and sauerkraut and potato all together, like in one bite.
Okay, in one, it's like the perfect bite?
Exactly.
Okay, so meat and potato and sauerkraut.
Careful, it's hot.
Oh my gosh. The potatoes are creamy. The sauerkraut is not tart.
No, not at all. It's kind of got a savory flavor, like a cabbagey flavor, but it maintains its integrity. It's still got some texture to it.
It's not salty.
No, it's not salty, and it shouldn't be salty. It shouldn't be vinegary. So I think it's a little bit hearty, but it's got the creamy potatoes. So it's a variety of textures that kind of all work together. And for me, it's the memory of my mom and my culture. And, you know, yeah, this is what I grew up with. This is kind of my home dish.
Contributor Lucian Jung produces our family recipe series. You can find previous episodes at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. It's been great having you along with us today. I hope you will be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.